Name something that gets passed around.
A joint.
A joint.
Legalized marijuana is always a very difficult question.
The time is long overdue for us to remove the federal prohibition on marijuana.
From now on, I smoke weed exclusively with white people.
Well, I'm getting higher next time.
They're walking on their pants with their cap on backwards, listening to the Animal Man, the Snoopy Snoopy Poop Dog.
There's definitely cannabis in there, and it makes sure that I can sleep now.
What's to keep somebody from getting all potted up on weed and then getting behind the wheel?
Don't piss off your old dealer.
Marijuana is not the kind of thing that ought to be legalized.
I know you're not supposed to admit that you smoke pot, but I don't drink alcohol.
Let's get out of here. I had some really good weed back at the hotel.
I used to smoke marijuana.
I don't care if an adult wants to smoke marijuana. They shouldn't go to prison for it either.
Welcome back, everybody. Special edition here of Toker Talk Radio with highlights from the Cannabis Collaborative Conference that took place today in Portland, Oregon, also taking place tomorrow. Get your tickets at ccc-con.com. It's the Men's Warehouse founder, George Zimmer, who's also a longtime marijuana user. A recent article explaining his 50-year love affair with cannabis is gone viral. He delivered the keynote speech earlier this morning.
Good morning, everybody. Let me get this out of the way so you don't have to wait till the end. I like the way you look. I guarantee it. I want to thank the our hosts for inviting me to join you in beautiful and always green Portland for the kickoff of the Cannabis Collaborative Conference. I look around this room and there are a lot of people who have dedicated their lives and in some cases risked their freedom to bring marijuana out of the shadows and to help end the failed war on drugs. Each of you is a pioneer and a leader and a true patriotic American. Being a leader is difficult, particularly when you have to fight unfair and prejudiced public opinion, as Steph was talking about a moment ago. But the good news is that public opinion has changed dramatically in our favor. California passed Proposition 64 last election day, making adult use of marijuana legal by over 56% of the vote. That translates into a landslide victory of over 1.5 million votes. I should point out that this does not go into effect until New Year's Day forthcoming. So if you go to California, make sure you have a medical card. In 1995, quite some time ago, I gathered a group of businessmen who shared my commitment to marijuana reform, and we got together on the Monterey Bay and actually planned what became known as Prop 215. The invitation that I sent out to my friends back in 95 said simply that the DEA is requesting the pleasure of your company at this meeting. And everybody asked me, what did DEA mean? And it meant, since we were on Monterey Bay, the Dunes Entertainment Authority. That day, I committed the not insignificant sum of $500,000 to begin the signature gathering process for Prop 215. My colleagues, George Soros, Peter Lewis, and John Sperling, joined me in that effort, and we were able to raise the money necessary to get 215 on the 96th ballot in California. It was a hard-fought campaign, during which five current and former presidents of the United States made a commercial against us, but we were able to prevail. And this really jump-started the process of sensible drug reform. Our campaign has changed minds and changed hearts. I take great pride whenever I see a newspaper or magazine talking about medical marijuana, because I do feel somewhat responsible for its success. There have been many bumps along the way, as Steph just commented on. There are many rogue U.S. attorneys around the country that are trying to harass medical marijuana providers. For those of us who have been following this closely, it seems like we take two steps forward and then one step back. Finally, on November 8th, 2016, despite the distressing election news concerning the presidential election, I was at a party in downtown Oakland celebrating the end of cannabis prohibition. Let me say that again. The end of cannabis prohibition. I've been working on this issue. I've been working on this issue for over 50 years, since I started college in 1966. And by the way, there is a report on one of the cable news stations that I've been smoking marijuana for 50 years. That is absolutely untrue. That's an old report. It's now 51 years. In my lifetime, I have experienced Richard Nixon and the Schaefer Commission in the early 1970s rejecting marijuana at that time as having no medical benefit. Nancy Reagan in the 80s with the Just Say No campaign. And my favorite, President Clinton in the 90s with his I Didn't Inhale. As we all know, this cannabis prohibition has resulted in billions of dollars in potential lost revenues, as well as millions of lives that have been adversely impacted, usually involving lawyers and jail time. The victory against prohibition last year in California and the victories that we've had in other states like here in Oregon, in Washington, Washington, D.C., Alaska, Colorado, Nevada, the list is growing. As Steph said, it's now over 40 states that have addressed this. And it really has accomplished three things. Number one, we have, I think, successfully stopped the demonization of cannabis and made recreational cannabis no different than beer, wine, and alcohol. Second, by ending the policy of mass incarceration, we have had millions of people successfully released from jail, all because the government decided to criminalize a plant. But the most important result of the last 20 years is that we are on the threshold now of creating an economic boom in this new emerging industry. I know that Steph talked a little bit of concern about the new Attorney General, Jefferson Beauregard Sessions III. I'm not quite as concerned as Steph, and I'll tell you why. Even though it was published that during an interview 25 years ago, Sessions made the comment that he thought the Ku Klux Klan was okay until he found out they smoked marijuana, I don't believe that President Trump is going to be able to stop the public momentum that has already developed. I think that if Attorney General Sessions were to try to set up the bus that went on after Prop 215 was passed, I think that he would find tremendous opposition. First of all, if you look at the picture of President Trump sitting in the White House with all the Silicon Valley execs, you'll notice that sitting right to the president's left was Peter Thiel, who's a great venture capitalist in the Bay Area and who has invested in a company which is already investing in the marijuana business. So I think it is unlikely that President Trump is going to move against us. As you heard, we are a $6.5 billion industry, but that's just beginning. And as many people know, we probably will become the largest agricultural crop in the entire country. A lot of business leaders are now getting involved in investing in marijuana. And I really think that if Mr. Thiel's support doesn't carry the day, that there are enough significant Americans that President Trump will not be able to change what we have already achieved. Now, what are the challenges that we have in this business? Well, we've heard a little bit about the banking challenge, and it really is a problem because this is a large business to be done in cash. It creates many problems, including a possibility of increased armed robberies. Banking is prohibited in this business, as are credit unions, but there are people working on this problem. In California, the state treasurer, John Chang, has convened the Cannabis Banking Working Group, which is comprised of experts from the cannabis industry, banks, tax agencies, regulators, and law enforcement to propose workable solutions to the cannabis banking challenge. In the state of Ohio, they passed a law, HB 523, which creates a closed loop system for medical marijuana patients in Ohio, where they're able to put up money in the form of a deposit and then have that applied against their medical marijuana purchases. These, of course, will not solve the problem permanently. Only complete and full legalization will enable the federal banking laws to be adjusted so that we can participate completely. Now, the next problem, as I think many of you here know, is that the IRS has an odd way of taxing marijuana businesses. The IRS code, section 280E, says no deduction or credit shall be allowed for any amount paid or incurred during the taxable year in carrying on any trade or business if such trade or business consists of trafficking in controlled substances, which means substances defined as Schedule I or Schedule II. This means that we are not allowed to deduct normal business expenses, but only deduct the actual cost of the product. This has become a way for the federal government to transfer what would be rightfully state and local tax revenue to the federal government through the IRS. I'm sure this is going to be up for change in the next few years. Right now, people in the cannabis industry are being forced to pay 40 to 70% to the IRS, which is just not sustainable. But there's one other financial problem, and that is that because we're locked out of the regular system, it becomes very hard to predict what the outcomes are going to be in the medical marijuana business. Without that predictability, capital formation, investment growth strategies, commercial lines of credit, debt service, most importantly, the return on investment, are not able to be calculated. In short, the kind of reasonable, predictable financial issues found in any normal business must be brought into our business. Now, there's one request that I'd like to leave you with, and this is a personal request because we are now starting to build a new industry. As you know, I built the Men's Warehouse starting in 1973, and I left about 4 years ago, primarily because of a disagreement concerning stakeholder capitalism versus shareholder capitalism. Shareholder capitalism is simply where the job of the CEO is to maximize shareholder return. Stakeholder capitalism, and I love being a capitalist, by the way, simply acknowledges that every business has many stakeholders beyond the shareholders, the employees, the customers, the communities, even the vendors, all have a vested interest in how a company conducts its business and not just in the outcome. What I'd like to leave you with is my wish that as we develop this new cannabis industry, that we make sure that it's a stakeholder industry and not just a shareholder industry, that we make sure that we have not just the profits that we're looking for, but that we look at the human condition that we are working at. I mean, most recently, we read about the Carrier Air Conditioning Company in Indianapolis that was closing a factory, and Trump got them to keep the factory open. When I read that, I thought, gee, that's what stakeholder capitalism is really all about, where you don't destroy a community just so you can make an extra dime for the shareholders. And we now have this wonderful opportunity to set the example, because I don't believe that shareholder capitalism, as it's been practiced in the United States since the Civil War, is sustainable. I don't think that you can ask people to maximize profits and maximize the communities at the same time. So my hope for everybody here is that as you go about creating your for-profit businesses, that you keep in mind that there are many stakeholders in your company, not just the investors. I've saved a little time, so if anybody would like to ask me any questions, we have a couple of minutes. If not, then carry on. Have a good day. Thank you.
I do have a question. Can you elaborate a little bit more what a stakeholder business would look like, or how to go about setting that up?
Right, thanks. A stakeholder is, and this is just my definition. So the workforce are stakeholders. Without unions, it's harder to see that, but collectively, the employees are stakeholders. Certainly, the customers are stakeholders. They care, as you heard, about whether there are pesticides being used on the product. Shareholders are also stakeholders, but so are the communities in which we do business, and I even include the vendors or suppliers to our companies. These stakeholders all have a vested interest in how we conduct our capitalistic business going forward to make sure that we build a sustainable system. I hope that answers it.
Thanks. One major responsibility is to encourage people to use less drugs.
All right, that sound means that it's 4:20 here in the Pacific time zone. Time for us to take our union-mandated safety briefing. Smoking if you got them. When we come back, we'll hear from Steph Shearer, her keynote speaker. She's the founder and executive director of Americans for Safe Access, the nation's leading medical marijuana advocacy organization. That's from the Cannabis Collaborative Conference, coming up next after this break.
At Herbie's Cannabis Seeds, we pride ourselves on bringing you the best quality seeds from the world's most respected cannabis seed producers, all at the lowest online prices. You can find Herbie's Seeds at herbiesheadshop.com. All cannabis seeds are sold as souvenirs, and as a means of preserving cannabis genetics, Herbie Seeds in no way intends to condone, promote, or incite the use of illegal or controlled substances. We strongly urge all prospective customers to check their national laws prior to placing an order. Herbie's Seeds at herbiesheadshop.com. Proud sponsors of The Russ Belville Show and 420 Radio.
You're listening to The Russ Belville Show.
Right now, marijuana is listed by the federal government as a Schedule I drug. That is absurd.
You can find Radical Russ online everywhere. Warning. Hits taken on this show are larger than they appear. Do not try this at home. These people are professionals. Or at least they pay me to say that.
Yeah, well, you know, that's just like your opinion, man.
A public service message from the Russ Belville Show.
Marijuana legalization is just the beginning of a process of restoring our natural rights to the cannabis plant. Join us now as we learn more about the rules, regulations, and court decisions that are shaping the landscape of legal marijuana in this edition of Pot Public Policy.
We go back to the Cannabis Collaborative Conference for the keynote speech by Steph Shearer, the executive director of Americans for Safe Access, the leading medical marijuana organization.
Good morning, everyone. Oh, is anyone here? Good morning, everyone. All right, it's a little bit better. My name is Steph Shearer. I already had an intro. I'm mostly a medical cannabis patient more than anything. I've been doing this work for about 15 years, and I've been a medical cannabis patient for 16. And after I leave here, I'm going to stop by a bar and go pick up my prescription. I'm just kidding. Please, Oregon, do not merge the two programs. As a medical cannabis patient, it is pretty humiliating to stand in line next to people who are getting a substance to go to a concert or have a good time when I need to talk about my medical use. That's a private conversation. So if you want to know what it looks like to merge the two programs, go talk to some patients in Washington. Pretty scary. But that's not what I'm here to talk about. I founded Americans for Safe Access after I became a patient in 2000. My kidneys actually started to fail because of side effects of ibuprofen and other anti-inflammatories. And I was living in San Diego at the time. I was 24. And luckily, my doctor knew a little bit about medical cannabis. In fact, one day he shut his door behind him, and he asked me if I smoked pot. And I told him I didn't. And he asked me if I knew where to get some. And I asked him if I was his youngest patient because I thought he was trying to score weed from me. But then he basically calmed me down and explained that he knew that cannabis was legal in the state of California, that he had two patients that were using cannabis as a substitute for anti-inflammatories and pain. And if I could find some, I should try it. So I was 24 living in San Diego. It wasn't that hard. I called all my friends that listened to Wu-Tang and reggae, and within a few days, I had some medicine, and it worked actually very well, except for I was annoying my friends because I was using all of their stash. And so then I began going to dealers, which, as you all know, wasn't something totally scary. It was just a little embarrassing asking a skater kid for your medicine and not being able to look at it before you buy it, all those fun things. And then a friend of mine told me about these dispensaries in the Bay Area of California, and that I should try one out. So I called one called Berkeley Patients Group. It's still open today. And told them I was a patient. They said I just needed to bring a letter from my doctor, and I could come in. I went up to Berkeley and went to my first medical cannabis dispensary, and I guess it kind of changed my life. But what was so exciting in the moment was that I actually had no idea that the bud was the part of the cannabis I was supposed to be using. I didn't know there were different strains. I didn't know there were different ways I could take it. And I could actually spend about 30 minutes talking to somebody about these things, right? And it felt dignified. And I left that experience with a two-week supply, and really felt like I was going to be okay. Then I went back down to San Diego, where there weren't yet dispensaries, and just realized that I couldn't spend my life going between dealers, and ended up moving up to the Bay Area of California. I had a political consulting firm at the time, so decided just to relocate. And I was there for 2 months when there was a federal raid on one of the facilities in San Francisco. And I think that's when I realized they were illegal. To be honest, when I went into Berkeley Patients Group and I used my credit card, it felt pretty legal. And it wasn't until this raid that I realized that every person that was involved in providing medicine for people like me were committing federal civil disobediences, which you all are today too. So all of you that raised your hand and said you were providing patients medicine, thank you so much. And that's what led me to start Americans for Safe Access. Asa Hutchinson was head of the DEA at the time. I actually thought I was just starting a little six-month campaign. Didn't realize 15 years later I would still be here. So we were ASA versus ASA, and that's where we got our name. So today what I want to talk to you about is, of course, I tried to use a little clever phraseology. But for those of you who are providing medicine to patients or providing cannabis to non-patients, I want to make sure that you all know that you are breaking federal laws and that you're committing a civil disobedience if you didn't know that. But also to talk to you a little bit about what's going to maybe be unfolding with this new administration. Sound fun? No, not really, I know. So Americans for Safe Access, we have over 100,000 patient members across the U.S. All of this you can read on my website. We do political work. We're both in the streets when we need to be. We're in on Capitol Hill. We're in state legislative offices. We do research. We actually just opened a research center in the Czech Republic in 2015. We work on consumer safety issues. We create product safety standards, work with governments to adopt those. And of course, we work on education. We've created continuing medical education courses for doctors. We've created tons of educational materials for patients, as well as elected officials. That's a little braggy slide. So when I started Americans for Safe Access in 2002, there were 8 states that had medical cannabis laws, and there were about 50,000 patients, right? So flash forward, we're up to 44 states that have some type of medical cannabis law, right? And about 2 million patients. So pretty big difference. And, that 15 years did not fly by. I feel every moment of it. I was 12 when I started ASA. I'm kidding. But just to give you a little picture, there were 11 dispensaries in the entire country. We had 80% support nationwide. There were 8 states that had medical cannabis laws, including Oregon, but those laws were really just criminal exemptions, which meant that if you got arrested and you had a letter from your doctor, you could show that letter to the judge and most likely get your sentences charged. There was nothing in these laws about access, about civil protections, etc. The feds had already started doing some raids and some civil actions towards people that were trying to provide medical cannabis. There were only a couple countries that had medical cannabis laws. Now we move forward to today. There's over 5,000 legally permitted businesses, and as we all know, a lot more than that as well. We have 89% support nationwide, 44 states, 19 countries now have medical cannabis laws. So, and the U.S. is not one of them, right? The U.S., we still do not have a medical cannabis program here. There's over 2 million medical cannabis patients. And right now we're under a ceasefire with the federal government between the Cole memo and the Roy Barker Farr Amendment. Right, so actually right now the Department of Justice cannot spend any money going after medical cannabis businesses. They can for recreational if they wanted to, because there's actually an amendment to their budget that doesn't allow them to spend any funds. But that bill is actually going to be expiring April 28th. So all of this happened under quite a bit of federal activity, federal interference. And one of the things that our organization has done over the years is actually cataloged every federal action towards medical cannabis since 1996, since the first laws. So over the years, and actually most of this was under Obama, the federal government has spent about $600 million arresting, investigating, prosecuting. Do you guys remember all the fun smash and grabs where they would go into medical cannabis dispensaries and just scare everyone, take everything? Thank goodness a lot of those people opened up the next day. So all of this progress, we went from 8 states to 44 states, really in the midst of a war. So we did this, we actually built support nationwide a few ways. One is that this is a program that I was hoping that I could retire, but we still have it, unfortunately. That's our RAID support program. We have Know Your Rights trainings and trainings for what to expect during a raid. Usually in medical cannabis or cannabis businesses, the managers and the owners, they've thought about what they would do if the DEA shows up, but they never talk to their staff about it. And so I know a lot of people talk about, you know, turning state's evidence or snitching. If you're a retail employee making 15 bucks an hour and a cop is screaming in your face that the owners are actually selling cocaine and not medical cannabis, and they're going to take your children from you, I don't know if I would call that snitching, especially if the owners didn't talk about what to do. So the good news is we've actually created all of these documents. We've created checklists. So if you're uncomfortable talking to your staff about it, you can just kind of go through, know what you're going to do during a raid. Make sure that you know who's going to pick up your children, who's going to feed your cat. The best way to get through a law enforcement encounter is for every single person that works with you to just shut the F up, right? To really not say a single word, and that's actually the best way to get through these successfully. But unless you practice that, unless your staff knows to do that, it's pretty hard to do. So we've created these trainings. Again, I was hoping I would never have to give one of these trainings again, but Attorney General Sessions has been confirmed, so we will see. We also have a way that patients can sign up to get text alerts during a raid. So over the years, all of those protests that happened around dispensaries, they weren't quite that organic. Literally every single raid, we actually organized over 500 demonstrations since we started ASA to protect people during raids. And so what happens is we'd find out that a raid is happening, we'd send out this text alert, and patients would go to the facility with signs that said, DEA taking my medicine. This is good because, of course, historically, it categorizes that it happened, right? That it makes sure that everyone knows that it actually happened. But also, police are better behaved if they're being watched. So this program, like I said, we did 500 of these demonstrations over the years. We also did court support, where we went into the courts when people were being prosecuted to make sure that the judges knew and the jury knew that they weren't alone. We also did a lot of citizen lobbying, which we continue to do, which I'll talk a little bit more about. But we have trained over 10,000 medical cannabis patients on how to talk to their elected officials. And we set up meetings with people's elected officials, both in their state and in D.C. This is just more federal interference. Just in case people don't realize, I know I don't mean to be Debbie Downer. I just want to make sure that we're all here next year. And these are things that I know people don't want to talk about. But I hear a lot of people in this industry talk about how this industry is too big to fail. And a $6 billion industry isn't that big, I'm sorry to say. In fact, some of your biggest opponents, like Sheldon Adelson, is worth about $30 billion. So just keep in mind that we are still part of a fight. This is a precious experiment that we all have to handle very carefully and mindfully. But what's exciting is a lot has changed over the last 15 years. When I first started Americans for Safe Access, the only groups that were lobbying on medical cannabis or even willing to talk about it were drug policy reform groups and some AIDS activist groups like ACT UP. But that was about it. When I went to friends that I had worked with on other health campaigns, you know, everyone really had an arm's distance to medical cannabis. But today, when we are lobbying on Capitol Hill, we're going in with organizations like MS Society, Epilepsy Foundation, Tourette's Association, the American Herbal Products Association. So it's pretty exciting. And a lot of work that we do is to really keep that coalition strong, make sure that they know how to respond to bad media stories that come out, as well as policy issues. So when a lot of people think about civil disobedience, this is what they think about, right? Some cute little girl getting arrested in front of a courthouse, maybe blocking the entrance. Well, this is me actually in 2002. And we were shutting down a federal courthouse in San Francisco because they were moving forward with the prosecution of Ed Rosenthal and Brian Eppes and a few others. So actually, we launched our campaign, Americans for Safe Access, by shutting down the federal courthouse in San Francisco and the Department of Justice in D.C. But this is one type of civil disobedience, and guess what I was charged for doing this? I think my charge was incommoding, one of my favorite. I've also been charged with possession of lumber and doing acrobatics in city without a net. Have been some of my favorite arrests. But this one was literally an infraction, right? This nice cop, he was whispering to me, he took me downstairs, he took my fingerprints, and I think I was out in 2 hours. For people who are in the cannabis industry, these are the charges that you're talking about, right? These are not small charges. There's a 5-year mandatory minimum sentence if you're cultivating more than 100 plants. There's a 10-year mandatory minimum sentence if you're growing more than 1,000. Sorry, this is an old one. And then you add on these sentences. If you're conspiring to grow 1,000 plants. Brian Eppes went to jail. He actually had under 100 plants, but they found an Excel where he was playing around and trying to figure out how he could grow 1,000 plants, and he spent 10 years in jail. So this isn't something it wasn't bad people, before the Cole memo that went to jail. It was people just like you, people who were, trying to find a way to make a living, were hoping to help out patients and doing something a little progressive, right? So right now we're in a ceasefire. Right? Well, right now your U.S. attorneys has been told to make these prosecutions of these laws the lowest priority. But that is just a policy. Does everyone understand that? Please tell me you do. Okay. And I'm so honored that you're willing to break these laws. I just want to make sure that people aren't going to be surprised or like it's so amazing that you do this and wake up every day doing this. But, for a lot of the raids that we saw over the last 10 years, they started off with actually one arrest, or maybe two arrests, and one of the people wasn't ready to be arrested, and they gave up a lot of information, and then it was 15 arrests and 20 arrests, right? So please talk about this with your business partners and with every employee, right? The person that you piss off who's watering your plants probably knows a lot about you. So just be smart, okay? So these are the two things. Cole memo, Attorney General Sessions, this is up to him. He can tear this up, and he's been telling members of the Justice Committee that he's going to. So what will he put in its place? We don't know. If you don't know who your U.S. attorney is, now is the time to meet them and get to know them very well, because it's really going to be up to your U.S. attorney of how voraciously they're going to apply these laws. The Roybacher Farm Amendment, as I mentioned, it's a nice. So we've got our president is sworn in, Congress is seated, AG Sessions is confirmed, and we have until the 28th of April to pass the CJS amendment again. All right, and so last year, right now we're actually living under the 2016 budget. because Congress couldn't get it together to pass a budget before the new president and new Congress came in. So right now, that budget is going to expire April 28th. Last year, we were able to pass the CJS amendment through the Senate Justice Committee, but that's it. Congress hadn't voted on it, right? So when you get emails from people like me saying, please call your member of Congress and make sure that they're going to vote for this, or your senators, please do it. And don't just, I mean, Oregon's good. You know, you guys have some pretty amazing representatives here. But so call your sister, your cousin, people in Iowa, other states, and make sure that they're calling their members of Congress. So the other thing I want to talk to you guys about is that when we think about civil disobedience, people often think about these agencies, right? DEA, IRS, Department of Justice. And, you know, I think that it would be really hard for the DEA tomorrow to get the public behind a full-on raid campaign where they just started going into facilities and shutting them down. I think that would cause a lot of problems with the public, right? But I think that the bigger plan is actually about turning the public against us. And the way that they can do this is through OSHA, the EPA, the FDA, and the USDA, right? So the community would be really upset if the DEA came in right now and shut down businesses that were providing medicine for their for patients in their community. But the community would be really excited to see the DEA come shut down people that were selling poison to patients. You know what I'm saying? Right? So, and this isn't some myth that these things are happening. OSHA has already fined businesses. They're already investigating businesses. They're showing up and fining. There's already been over $500,000 worth of fines that have come from OSHA. So a press release from the DEA saying that business is horrible to its employees, right? All of a sudden, it turns the community against the industry. EPA, if EPA says that actually folks are putting poison in the groundwater, they're not supporting patients, they're actually poisoning your community, then all of a sudden, the community is happy to see the DEA, right? So if you are in this industry, right, and the regulations of your state or your community don't require you to go out of your way to ensure worker safety, to ensure environmental safety, to ensure product safety, then it is up to you to do it. Because we've already seen reports from the FDA. They're going around to dispensaries, and they're testing the products, and they're publishing it. And it doesn't look good. Why would you sell pesticides to a patient? I can't stand behind you if you do that. Right? And so I don't think the rest of the United States will either. So it is time to be mindful. And I'll also say, the general public doesn't understand who's a good guy and who's a bad guy in the cannabis industry. They can barely understand who's medical and who's recreational. Right? So the worst actor in your community, right, is painting the picture of who you all are. You can't just turn your back on that person. You need to get active and figure out how you can get them in line. Because it's going to be that's going to be the dispensary or the cultivation site where the DEA shows up, where they bring cameras, where they do exposés, right? In a way that can bring down this whole project. If you would not give any product that you're selling your mother to your sister without question, then you should not be selling it to patients. You should not be pushing the buck and say, oh, but the lab said this was fine. Investigate the lab. Make sure the lab knows what they're doing. Because this is up to you, and this is about your freedom at the end of the day. I was going to go through. I'm running out of time to go to talk about everything that we're doing. But I'm going to give you some good news. So, obviously, we have to pass the CJS amendment again this year. We're working on passing comprehensive legislation that would finally end the state and federal conflict. But we need everyone's help, right? I know people are thinking about the next regulation that's right in front of you, but if we don't end this federal conflict, it could start rolling back on us, right? And so, you know, don't expect that somebody else is going to be doing this work. If you should know who every one of your elected officials are, You should know who your U.S. attorney is, and you should be calling them on a pretty regular basis. But I want to tell you guys about a cool, something that just happened. We filed a petition using the Information Quality Act on December 5th of last year. What we did is we actually took this document, the first picture here, which was, I think you guys all remember this, the DEA denied the scheduling of marijuana. Everyone remember that came out? Did anyone read anything beside the headline? Okay. Well, if you read the report, you would find out that actually the DEA conceded on some pretty important issues about cannabis that our opponents use pretty regularly. What they said is that there's no scientific basis for the gateway theory, there's no scientific basis for long-term brain damage, and there's no scientific basis for psychosis or lung cancer. Right? Do you guys know what our opponents talk about? So they put this in this one document, but they actually, in the documents, the dangers and consequences of marijuana and drugs of abuse, they still talk about those four issues. So we went through those documents. We found 25 violations of the Information Quality Act, which I know you guys all think it's legal for the federal government to lie. They actually can't. There's a law passed in 94 called the Information Quality Act. That requires that there is a level of integrity in all information that's disseminated by federal agencies. And it also gave citizens to be able to ask for that information to be corrected. And so on December 5th, that's what we did. And we actually teamed up with ORIC, a law firm that's been doing pro bono work for us. And as of last week, the DEA took down this document. This is where, yeah. So this is out of the 25, 23 of the 25 violations were in this. They put up some other documents, so this is going to be a constant battle. But as we're moving forward, we want to make sure that this conversation that we're having with the federal government is had with science, especially since we know how much Jeff Sessions loves the DEA. We have a conference that's coming up in April in Washington, D.C., April 7th through 11th. We bring patients from all over the country to D.C. If it's not an industry conference, although we do have an industry stakeholders meeting that's there, and it's a great time for various stakeholders to communicate. But if you can't make it, please consider donating to our organization so we can bring patients out that are in areas that maybe aren't as liberal as Oregon to talk to their elected officials. I was going to tell you about a bunch of programs, but I got too excited telling you not to get arrested. There's one other thing I want to tell you about, which is a program that we've designed to help the industry. And this is called patient-focused certification. We began working with the American Herbal Products Association in 2011 to create product safety standards for the medical cannabis industry. So we've created best practice standards on cultivation, manufacturing, laboratories, and distribution. We now have been working with governments across the U.S. and have gotten these best practices adopted in 19 states. And we're continuing to work with governments to get them adopted. We've created educational programs. We have physical audits. And if you can make it through our certification program, then you're not going to have to worry about what will happen when OSHA or FDA shows up at your facility. We've made this, put this in a way to make sure that everyone can move forward who wants to as the industry evolves, right? Often regulations are used as a way to push out the smaller farmers, to push out the mom and pops, right? It's a pretty common cornerstone of capitalism. One of the ways that they do that is by saying, look, these people are not regulated, right? And creating regulations that would be very hard for you all to meet. But we've created these regulations with input from the industry, right, that are actually, they're obtainable, they're something that you can adhere to, and educate yourself on how to do this, so that you can compete with these other businesses in this evolving market. One other thing I would like you to know is we also created an international medical cannabis patients coalition. We're now working in 42 countries. We've been able to pass medical cannabis laws now in 19 countries. But something really exciting that just happened is that we were actually able to move the WHO and the UN forward on the process of rescheduling. Marijuana is a Schedule I drug within the UN single treaty. It's something that the U.S. actually pushed on every other country. But that document that made cannabis a Schedule I drug was actually based on a report that was created in 1935. So through Americans for Safe Access and our partners through IMCPC, we began engaging with the WHO. At our conference, we created a pre-critical review document to give to the WHO so that they could move forward. And we just found out in November that they are moving forward, that they're actually going to be developing a critical review and reevaluating the scheduling of cannabis at the international level. So pretty exciting stuff. I know my time's up, but just a couple other things. We also created a research center in the Czech Republic. We helped pass the law there in 2012. And after implementing and found that we had a country that was excited to study cannabis and had a pretty remarkable academic resources. And some of the things that we're looking at doing there is where we've already started some human clinical trials, but we're doing pesticide tolerance testing. We're doing Appalachian standards for international. We're actually working with Jamaica and India right now. And then we're also working on a research priority map, actually looking at everything that's out there known about cannabis and putting together a document that will help us save resources, really a couple of resources to move research towards access. We're a nonprofit. If you loved everything I said, please become a member. And I just want to say thank you to our sponsors and also to our partners who make this happen. Thank you guys so much. I'll see you in D.C. hopefully.
That's Steph Scherer earlier this morning at the Cannabis Collaborative Conference at the Portland Expo Center. The conference is still going on today, and tomorrow you can have a one-day pass for the sessions and the expo floor for $149. The expo floor by itself, just $49. You can get your tickets at ccc-con.com, and those will be online all night long. Like get out there to the Portland Expo Center and see what's going on. They got a lot of great speakers coming tomorrow. Folks from the OLCC, Oregon Department of Agriculture, Oregon Health Authority, and OSHA. OSHA will be there as well if you'd like to get some regulatory information. Back with a mini radical rant right after this.
This is the Russ Belville Show on CannabisRadio.com.
Everybody, it's Radical Russ here from 420 Radio, inviting you to be like me and get your ink done at Lucky Horseshoe Tattoo, Fort Worth's most female-friendly, clean, sterile, awesome tattoo shop. Thomas and his crew are true artists who can design you a custom piece or use a design you bring in. Lucky Horseshoe Tattoo also offers all styles of tattooing as well as piercings and all-around fun. In the DFW area, stop by Lucky Horseshoe Tattoo and tell them Radical Russ sent you. Trust me, it'll feel awesome.
You're listening to the Russ Belville Show.
Half of what we spend on law enforcement, half what we spend on the courts, and half of what we spend on the prisons is drug-related. And to what end?
You can find Radical Russ online everywhere. Warning. Hits taken on this show are larger than they appear. Do not try this at home. These people are professionals. Or at least they... pay me to say that.
It's no bong. It's for my schlong.
A public service message from the Russ Belville Show.
Total war against public enemy number one.
10 federal criminal penalties for up to 1 ounce of marijuana.
Marijuana is probably the most dangerous drug.
Just say no.
Legalization is just another word for surrender.
I experimented with marijuana and didn't inhale.
This is not medicine. This is a Cheech and Chong show.
Encourage people to use less drugs.
I am ill.
That was the point.
I think we'd be a mistake to leave the state.
Negative reports coming out of Colorado.
Don't smoke marijuana.
Marijuana.
Radical Rant.
You're listening.
Mentioning earlier, you heard Americans for Safe Access Executive Director Steph Shearer open her speech at the Cannabis Collaborative Conference with a little joke that after the event, she would be making her way to a bar so she could pick up her recommended medical marijuana. And then she goes on to explain how humiliating it is to have to shop with people who are just in line to buy some pot so they can go to the concert and get high, or however it is that she referred to it. And it just reiterates a certain aspect of the medical marijuana side of our movement that has always gotten under my skin. It's something I call the patients, not criminals, people. The people that feel maybe, I don't know, a personal shame in being a marijuana consumer and feel the need to have to always say it's their medicine and always point out that they're a medical consumer, and at any opportunity they can, throw recreational consumers like me under the bus in order to present their side as having a better moral high ground for their use of cannabis. I don't know what's so humiliating about having to shop with those of us who may be using cannabis for other reasons. I understand patients wanting to have some privacy when they talk to someone about their medical needs. That doesn't mean we have to shop in two different stores and have to deal with two different inventories and have two different regulatory systems and have everything being duplicated just so you can get some privacy when you want to talk about your pain or your spasticity or whatever it might be. I go to the Safeway store all the time to buy alcohol, you know, get some apple cider so I can have a little fun, maybe some chips and salsa to nosh on while I'm watching TV. And at that Safeway, there's a pharmacy, and they have a little rope line and a sign that says, stand here behind here for privacy. They have you stand about 4 feet back from the counter so that there can be some privacy in the discussion with the pharmacist. Isn't that good enough? Couldn't we make that the standard in a pot shop? I don't know how they're all run, and I only go to the recreational shops. But the ones I've been to here in Portland, when they buzz you in the door, it's not like there's a huge crowd of people there. They let one or two or three people in at a time for a one-on-one encounter with their bud tender. It's not like there's a ton of people sitting over my shoulder when I'm talking to them about what sort of strain I might want to get. In Washington State now, I've gone to the Main Street Marijuana, and it is, in Washington State, at least at Main Street Marijuana, very packed retail environment. And I can see where that would be troublesome for patients wanting to get their medicine. But continuing to point at Washington State and saying that's the inevitable result of merging medical and recreational, I think is a disservice. I think the two can be merged. I think there should only be one system. It is a plant, and regardless of why you're using it, we can still test it the same, we can still regulate it the same, we can still retail it the same. Make the standards for marijuana good enough for the sickest patient. We regular consumers won't mind if our marijuana is well tested and pure. We won't mind if we get better quality cannabis. We won't mind if there's more restrictions that keep bad actors out. Make it good enough for the patients, and it'll be more than good enough for everyone else. But stop this patients not criminals attitude. Stop disparaging people like me. You can be pro-patient without having to be anti-PAGA. Well, folks, that's all the time we've got for today's show. Thanks for joining us. And remember, tomorrow I'll be off the air because I'll be traveling down Interstate 5 making my way to the International Cannabis Business Conference. Tomorrow I'll be at the VIP session that has Lieutenant Governor Gavin Newsom of California, John Sally, Henry Rollins, and Tommy Chong. We'll try to get you audio with all of them on Friday's show. For everyone here at Delta 9 Studios, I'm Radical Russ. Thanks for joining us, and until next time, take care of each other, tokers!
This is the Russ Belville Show. The Russ Belville Show is blogging and podcasting daily at RadicalRuss.com. You're growing, you're giant, you're rolling, you're smoking. You
take a scene, you plan it, you grow it, you try it, you roll it, you smoke it. You take a scene, you plan it, you grow it, you try it, you roll it, you smoke it, and it goes down smooth.
You're listening to the Russ Belville Show.
Marijuana is not heroin.
You can find Radical Russ online everywhere.